Game on 2FM with Green Firm. Fuel your day with Green Firm's new high-protein cooked chicken breast fillets. 100% natural and packed with flavour.
Thanks to Jenny Green for bringing us to the end of the week. It's Friday the 8th of October and this is Game On. Coming up today, we'll hear from the Irish camp in Baku as they put the focus on 3 points rather than two jabs.
What I could say is about Callum Robinson is that, you know, he's such a popular member of the squad. He's a breath of fresh air. He always comes in with a smile on his face. He's infectious. He has attracted a lot of criticism because he just came into a press conference where vast majority of players refuse to answer the questions. He was open and transparent.
We'll have live updates as our under-21s are in action at present, and we'll hear from Oriel Park ahead of Dundalk versus Shamrock Rovers. Meanwhile, in boxing, Gavin Casey is with us to preview Tyson Fury and Deontay Wilder's close encounter of the third kind.
Game on 2FM.
We'll have all that and Jane Mangan on the weekend's racing. If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM. Paul Corry is with me live in studio, very closely watching the Republic of Ireland under-21s versus Luxembourg. It is half-time and Ireland are leading 1-0, Paul.
They are indeed. It was a bit of a slow half, Marie, and Ireland in particular were a bit slow out of the box, I thought. There was no real tempo to their play. The passing was slow. We had a lot of the ball and a lot of possession. We're not really doing too much with it, and the back four seemed to be just kind of shifting it side to side without really penetrating Luxembourg. But it picked up then after about 15 minutes. I said the move of the game so far, lovely ball from Conor Coventry, switched out to Tyreek Rice. He's a really direct winger, Marie, somebody you could get excited about. He took on the fullback and he's pulled it across the face of goal, and JJ Keogh has tapped it in. And to be honest with you, Marie, that was probably the only real kind of spark in the first half. After that, again, our tempo died away. And I think Jim Crawford would be disappointed because it's just been sloppy at times, particularly when there's been no pressure on the ball. And Luxembourg are absolutely brutal. Like, terrible. Honestly, I play five-a-side on a Saturday morning, Marie, and they're not too much above that standard.
Well, to be fair, you are a former professional footballer, I'd imagine you're playing with a few good lads.
Well, David Schneid plays now and again.
Apologies if you're listening, David.
They're just not up to much, Marie. And Ireland have all the ball. So, you know, I'd say that the word at half time from Jim Crawford would be just move it quicker, be more precise with your passing, get at Luxembourg and just keep the ball moving and take the legs away from them. And after 60 minutes, you'd imagine that there's going to be chances there for JJ Keogh to add to the goal he's already had. I think Ross Tierney's been good. I always like him when I see him play. There's an honesty about him, and he brings a tempo to his game and an energy that is almost infectious around the rest of the squad. I'd be really surprised if he's at Bowes over the next 18 months. I could see him moving away. And outside of that, you're probably expecting a bit more from Coventry and Kilkenny in the middle of the pitch. You look at the 21s teams, probably not as many familiar faces as the previous one that Stephen Kenny had, and Coventry and Kilkenny would be two of the more experienced, and just probably expect a little bit more out of them. I like the angles Coventry picks up. I like how he keeps the game simple, but I think he can do more and just put a bit more tempo in his play, and then the others could pick up off that.
The conversations that we've been having over the last year or so have very much been focused on, a universal style of play for Ireland teams, that whatever Stephen Kenny is doing at the top, we will see filtered down through all the underage setups so that they're able to slot into a senior team when the time comes. Obviously, when you look at under 21 teams from the past, we've seen so many players come through that system and then on to the Ireland team. Are you seeing any sort of a continuity when it comes to style of play between what Jim Crawford and the under 21 team are doing right now and what Stephen Kenny is trying to do?
I think Jim is very much in sync with Stephen, and that would go back to his time, and it would bode well that they work together at the 21s. Yes, we do have probably a bit more of a pattern to our play. The one concern I would have is if you're gonna play that way, you need to do it better than what we showed in that first half. And at times that could probably be said about the senior team as well, that we need to be better in possession of the ball. But there is, you know, there's patterns to our play, and there's, I guess, styles of play and moves that we're putting together that you would see reciprocated across both teams. And I guess the idea behind that is if you formula that when the players go and they step into the senior team, they're going to be a bit more familiar with it. Any under-21s team, Marie, that I look at, you know, it's very unlikely that you're going to get 11 of those players who are going to step up to senior international football. For me, I think if you look at the likes of Coventry, Kilkenny, and but potentially one more, but they'd probably be the two that you'd be looking at actually progressing to the next level. And listen, if they're going to make that step up based on the first half, then they need to do more.
Okay, well, we'll be keeping an eye on the second half of that. Now we are going to cross over to Oriel Park to Adrian Eames. Dundalk and Shamrock Rovers are going to do battle there tonight. It's the only League of Ireland game on tonight because of that under 21 saga that we were talking about a little bit earlier in the week. We might get to again a little bit later in the show. But Adrian, to you now, look, it's Dundalk, Shamrock Rovers. It might not be a title race where the two of the top teams of late anyway have been battling out like they have in the past, but there's still something quite intriguing when these two sides meet.
Oh, absolutely. Every time they go toe-to-toe, it's compulsive viewing. And of course, the game is live on RT2 television a little bit later on. And Dundalk, as you say, they're floundering at the moment down near the lower part of the table. But they have the opportunity, if they win here tonight, Marie, to jump to sixth in the table. And given the way the season has gone for them, that would be a significant move, given that this is the only show in town, the only game in the Premier Division. So Dundalk have an opportunity to steal a march and climb away from that relegation playoff spot. And obviously Shamrock Rovers, they're coasting towards the title. 9 points clear. They could make it 12 tonight if they win. And matches generally are very tight between these two sides. Shamrock Rovers have won both the home games at Tallaght Stadium, but they lost here back in May to Dundalk. And as you say, when these two slug it out, it's usually very, very fascinating. And I expect this evening will be as well. Obviously, both sides will be keen to get points on the board. I think a point here wouldn't be necessarily a bad result for Shamrock Rovers, given where they are and given the size of their lead. Dundalk, though, you perhaps feel need to really lay down a marker and gather further momentum, but they're in good form, unbeaten in their last five in all competitions. Likewise, Shamrock Rovers, they're on a good run as well, unbeaten in their last four. They've won their last four after a very dodgy spell when they lost four in succession. So it's nicely set up for a very good encounter on what is a very pleasant evening.
Paul Corry is with me here in studio as well. Paul, I know you know a few of the players quite well. Is there still a rivalry there between the players, or is it a case that Shamrock Rovers would just see themselves so far ahead now of Dundalk right now?
I think there is. I think naturally enough, albeit Dundalk are down, you know, the base of the table at the moment, they still have the most competitive squad. When you compare the two teams and you compare the rest of what's available in the league, it does take a bit of the spark out of it tonight when Dundalk are so far behind Shamrock Rovers. But you know, there's going to be a bit of movement, I would imagine, in and out of Dundalk at the end of this summer. And if you're to ask the majority of those players where would they like to go play, I would say Derry be up around there now with the new budget they have, and also to Shamrock Rovers. So there's always a bit of needle in these games, and I think that just comes with the fact that they've been competing for leagues and cups over the last couple of years, and they want to better themselves and they want to be the team that is, I guess, perceived as being the best in town at this moment in time. It's obviously not happened for Dundalk this year, but they still have, you know, when you compare starting 11s across the league, they're by far and away the closest to Shamrock Rovers. So I think it's interesting that Finney's gone back. He's kind of gone back to the tried and trusted, and I think with that in mind, given the fact how well the two teams know each other, it could lend itself to a really good game tonight.
Yeah, it does sound like it is. Just interestingly on Shamrock Rovers, Adrian, they have been getting a little bit of criticism because they're not playing maybe as well as we've seen them play in the past, and like obviously some of their big names have departed, but it's almost a case that they don't need to, because okay, they had that dodgy period that you mentioned, but they're still winning games.
That's the thing. That's the key to it. They're grinding out results. It may not be the flamboyant Shamrock Rovers that we perhaps witnessed last year in that curtailed season, but bear in mind, you know, they lost Jack Byrne and obviously Aaron McInniff, two real high quality flair players. Now, admittedly, the likes of Danny Mandrew has come in and he's added that kind of panache to their starting 11. But at the same time, yeah, they're more effective than they were last year. Last year they were, you know, really thrilling to watch, whereas this season they're more organised and they get results and they do what's required and they get points on the board. And up front they got Rory Gaffney, who's managed to get a few goals. And it's a very solid Shamrock Rovers side. Certainly not as spectacular as last year's, but they're getting the business done. And, you know, they haven't really hammered teams in the league. Some of the results and some of the wins have been tight enough affairs, but they're doing enough and they're so far ahead that the chasing pack haven't really managed to land a glove on them.
Yeah, well, we will have some team news later on. Adrian Eames, thank you so much for joining us. Now we are going to turn our attention to the big one, the Republic of Ireland versus Azerbaijan, which takes place tomorrow. Fergal Brennan, journalist, is with us now. Fergal, you know, we're going to start a preview of a Republic of Ireland game, and we're going to start with COVID because that seems like what we always do these days. But there has been a huge amount of focus on Callum Robinson's revelation that he has not yet, in this moment in time, got the vaccine. And actually, John Egan was asked about Callum's press conference earlier in the week when he made this revelation, and the subsequent coverage that that there was of those revelations, and there was a lot of focus on Callum Robinson. There was a lot of criticism too, a pretty big pile on. Let's hear what John Egan had to say.
I suppose first and foremost, Cal was asked a question. You know, he gave an answer. He didn't come out and say he was against the vaccination or anything. So, you know, I was quite disappointed to see how many people jumped down his throat. You know, everybody has a choice whether to get the vaccination or not, and you know, it's personal choice. So, you know, as a teammate, as a friend, you know, I back my teammates, I back my friends. But, you know, I don't think Cal came out and said he was against the vaccination. I think he simply just answered a question and said he hasn't had it yet. So as far as that's concerned, you know, Cal's a teammate of mine, he's a friend of mine, and you know, hopefully now we can kick on with Ireland and do well.
Fergal, it's really interesting that Callum Robinson is one of the first people to actually come out and comment on this. When you think of all the press conferences that you've probably been at in the last few months, the amount of players that have been interviewed, but yet it's Callum Robinson who seems to have gone global with his answer to this, which is quite strange.
Yeah, I think it's primarily to do with the straightness in the way that he answered the question. As you say, press conferences for the last couple of months, that question has been dropped into to players and to managers regarding vaccination of players. Have they been vaccinated? What are the numbers within a squad? What has been the attitude towards taking the vaccine? And I think Callum Robinson, the sense that I got from the press conference was that there was a bit of surprise from the journalists that were there, that he answered it in quite a frank and quite an upright manner in terms of his views on it, that he has opted not to have it, that he doesn't feel that he needs it, despite the fact that obviously he has tested positive twice and that's caused him to miss games for Ireland and miss games for West Brom. And I think there's a very tiny bit of sympathy that I do have for him. There was always going to be the first player to come out and openly say it, because I think by and large, press conferences over the last month, players have just trotted out a relatively generic answer, or managers have been instructed by the press office to just kind of reiterate at a very generic point. There was always going to be criticism of him, and likewise John Egan or Stephen Kenny or another Ireland player was always going to back him. These things are as logical as night and day following each other as they go on. In terms of his personal attitude towards his comments, I don't think that the public backlash is going to change his mind. He will be being advised by the medical team with Ireland and with West Brom, and if they haven't convinced him to take the vaccine or the benefits of being vaccinated, then I don't necessarily think that is going to change anything. In terms of the public reaction, I'm not particularly surprised, and in terms of John Egan backing his teammate, and they were formerly club teammates when he was at Sheffield United, I'm not particularly surprised either. I don't think Robinson's stance is going to change, and in fairness to Robinson, he's not the only Premier League or Championship footballer that's not had it. He's just the first one to publicly say it.
Paul, you're not out of the dressing room that long. What are your thoughts on it?
I'm probably, you know, I'm sure everybody's not on the same hymn sheet about it, but I'm probably more in the Jurgen Klopp side of things, where he says that people have a responsibility to society and to those around them to, you know, to get vaccinated. It just surprises me. I wonder, you know, is there a doubt from players with regards to performance levels, or what is it that it's going to, you know, tinker with their cardiovascular system, or what it might be? Because it seems as if that there is a bit of a trend along certain athletes that they don't want to get vaccinated, and there has to be a reasoning behind that. I know Stephen Kenny has come out and said that some of the information that they're actually digesting isn't brilliant, or isn't actually factually true, mm-hmm. and maybe that's creating a bit of a stigma. So to be honest with you, Maria, I probably don't view it from a sporting point of view. I probably just look at it more from a society standpoint. Yeah, and Jurgen Klopp, and I think as role models and as players who a lot of people look up to, it probably doesn't come across great when you've got somebody who, you know, I didn't think Callum's reasonings for not having the vaccine were really adding up. In my head, I didn't think it was really concrete as to why he wasn't getting it, particularly when he was actually kind of explaining how many times he'd had had COVID-19 and the impact that it had on his breathing. So it's a touchy subject. It's really difficult. It's one where I don't tend to project my kind of opinions on other people. It's a personal stance that I have, and I think it's more probably one from a society as opposed to a sporting point of view.
Well, unsurprisingly, Stephen Kenny was asked about it as well and the coverage of Callum's decision. Let's hear from that.
You know, what I could say is about Callum Robinson is that, you know, he's such a popular member of the squad. He's a breath of fresh air. He always comes in with a smile on his face. He's infectious. You know, he brings laughter to the dressing room. People love him. He's very, you know, he has great qualities as a man, great qualities as a human being. He has attracted a lot of criticism. Because he just came into a press conference and where vast majority of players don't answer, refuse to answer the questions, he was open and transparent, and he has been vilified for it. But he is a terrific person, and I think that all of the players would verify that. They really speak so well of him, and, you know, he's a very, very popular member of the squad.
And finally, Stephen, has it affected the build-up at all to this game?
Not in the slightest, no. Not in the slightest. Preparation has been good. We had a couple of good days training in Dublin. We're delighted to get it. It was terrific. We trained in Abbottstown Monday and Tuesday. Obviously, 8-hour flight on Wednesday, so, and the time difference, so that you know, the players had to adjust to that then with training yesterday. But we're looking forward. We're training the stadium this evening now and looking forward to it, and we'll be absolutely ready for the game. We're very, you know, we're very excited about the game. We're looking forward to it. Preparations have gone well. And now that has had no impact whatsoever.
Look, and unsurprisingly as well that Stephen Kenny would come out and back his player, especially just given the amount of reaction that Callum had to deal with after he made that revelation. But just moving on a little bit from that, when Stephen Kenny arrived in Baku with his squad, he was dealt another blow with the news that Adam Ida and Jason Knight both missed training because they felt unwell. They had a fever and high temperature. It's not believed to be COVID, though, as they both returned a negative PCR test. It's just bad luck after bad luck, really, Fergal, isn't it?
It is, and I think kind of that's been the reaction to the news regarding Ida and Jason Knight, that every squad Stephen Kenny has called up, every time an international window has rolled around, there's been some sort of an issue, whether it's a late withdrawal from an injury. And in terms of the impact on COVID, I'd struggle to think of an international squad that's had as much bad luck as Ireland when it comes to either positive tests, close contacts, anything relating to regulations surrounding the virus and travel and coming into contact with other players. It's almost become a kind of little bit of gallows humour with Stephen Kenny and surrounding the Ireland squad at the minute, but it is genuinely just very, very, very bad luck. But on the positive side, Ida and Knight, in terms of the testing, as you say, they've returned negative PCR tests. Whether or not they will be fit, because they are obviously unwell for tomorrow, is remains to be seen in the next 24 hours. If they're too unwell to train today or to really be involved, you'd probably say it's unlikely that they'll play tomorrow, particularly Ida, who's been ever present for Kenny since he's come in. That'll be a blow, and it'll be a blow to the preparations and the plans. They will have planned for, definitely I would say, Ida to start up front and possibly, probably Jason Knight to play some role in midfield. And it's another blow for Stephen Kenny, but in terms of his reaction to these situations, he is resilient. He will have a backup plan, because we all know that tomorrow night is absolutely massive in terms of his future as Ireland manager.
Yeah, it really is, Paul. And I guess, look, the only positive I can find on what has happened in the last couple of days to the Ireland camp is that at least we're talking about something else rather than how much pressure Stephen Kenny is under.
It has deflected. It's deflected away from, you know, I wouldn't say nonsense, but the tone of the news, particularly over the last couple of international breaks. I think, you know, Callum Robinson, when you actually stop talking about, you know, vaccines and whether he's vaccinated or not, he's a big player for us, and he's somebody who we actually really need to perform, because he was good when he came on against Serbia. He was instrumental in the goal. I always think there's a brightness to his play, and we probably lack kind of somebody with his burst over 5-10 yards that he gives us. So listen, it's a must win game, and I don't mean that in the sake of Stephen's job. I just mean with regards to what we're building, the performances. There has to at some point come this win that we've been craving over the last, or since Stephen has come in. So Yeah, no, you know, we're obviously missing the likes of a Seamus Coleman and potentially an Adam Eda, but there should be enough Murray within that squad. You know, we should have enough quality to actually go to Azerbaijan and win. It's not by any means going to be an easy game where we don't create a huge amount of chances. I don't think that's going to change tomorrow, but we certainly have the players there and they've spent enough time together training. We've had a good run into this game and in previous camps that this needs for me to be the game that we go and we win. It doesn't have to be the most convincing of performances, but we need to go and we need to get this monkey off our back because it's a long time coming around.
The reality is though, Fergal, that they struggled against Azerbaijan not so long ago, so they're going to need to really improve on performance.
Yeah, and as Paul rightly says, whether Ida plays or one or two others are missing, Ireland should still have enough to beat Azerbaijan. We should have had enough to beat them in Dublin, but that wasn't the case. I think this is a big thing for Stephen Kenny, the competitive win, to get it done, to get it ticked off, because the positivity that is surrounding him is still noticeable, particularly we saw that in the home games in the last window, because there is a faith that the team is moving in the right direction. But he ultimately knows that the big criticism that is being levelled at him is results. He knows that if he can block that, prevent that criticism from rolling over into the new year and potentially into another qualification campaign should his contract be extended, that's the only real battle he needs to win. In terms of the direction that the team is moving in, I think he's won that battle, and I'm in favour of that, because he has changed a lot of mentalities about the way football should be played, the way young players should be promoted, and the standards that Irish players should hold themselves to. I think that's a massive positive. But ultimately, the kind of bottom line argument that is railed against him is this results idea. I personally think that's fairly reductive, because I think it only kind of forces us down one way in this conversation. But he does know that he needs to block that negativity from getting any further. And he also knows that this team, particularly a young team, a big win away from home will power some confidence into them. World Cup qualification, I think off the top of my head, is pretty much mathematically gone. But he knows now that this is a long-term plan, and the players are buying into that. The players are not coming out with generic statements in press conferences. They're genuinely behind what Stephen Kenny is doing. We saw that with John Egan today, Matt Doherty in the past, and other players. That is the case, and moving forward, that needs to be the case. But tomorrow night, 3 points, even if World Cup qualification is gone, which it more than likely is, will be a massive boost for him, for the players and for the supporters.
Yeah, really well. And there will have been plenty of lessons learned from that first Azerbaijan game. Let's hear what Stephen Kenny had to say about it.
Well, certainly, there were lessons to be learned from the game. I think both out of possession in that first half period, and certainly in possession in both halves, in fact. And I think, listen, we've learned some lessons from the game, even though we did create the vast majority of the chances in the game, and had we just been more clinical in front of goal, we might even be having a discussion now. But it was a good learning curve for us, and we do need to improve on that performance in certain areas, and are determined to do that. I think there was a lot of good play in that match as well. We obviously when Azerbaijan defended deeper in the second half and we pushed right on, a lot of our chances came from crosses. So we have to have the ability, you're right, you make the point, we have to have the ability to play through Azerbaijan. And we acknowledge that that's something we have to improve. And so that's, we're looking forward to the challenge tomorrow night, because Azerbaijan have some good players, there's no doubt about that. But we're in a confident mood. We've had, a strong last window with the performances against Portugal and Serbia as well. And I think we want to turn the recent draws into victories tomorrow night. That's the ambition. That's certainly what we want to do.
There has been some good performances, Paul, but we're still not scoring the goals. It's like the age-old question, where are the goals going to come from?
Yeah, it is a good question. And that's probably the one piece of Adam Eda's game that I'd love to see him just do a little better with. I even thought when they played against Liverpool in the League Cup, there was one or two chances that fell his way that he probably should have put away. And for all his endeavour and all his good hold-up play, that is actually the piece of the jigsaw that we really desperately need. So whether it's to be himself or Callum Robinson or a Troy Parrott, we need to start finding goals from somewhere. I guess the encouraging thing I would say, Marie, is within those performances, Stephen has mentioned it there, we did create more chances. And in previous campaigns, I thought we were so starved, particularly in the final third. We didn't even realise, or didn't look like we knew where we were going with the ball, or how we were going to get in behind oppositions, or how we were going to threaten and play through, like Stephen mentioned. I think the five, and I think getting Matt Doherty, and whether it be Enda Stevens or James McLean, into advanced positions is our best point of attack and getting balls into the box and causing teams issues. And of course, then on top of that, you have our set piece threat. I don't think we're ever going to be the type of nation who's going to, you know, knit the ball like a Spain or France and go through teams with a Busquets and link it off a front man and have lovely third man runners. I think we need to be efficient, realise what we're good at, get the ball wide, get people in the box and hopefully cause teams problems. And I think when you do that enough and you give yourself those opportunities, I think the goals will start to come. And hopefully with the likes of an Eder or Parrott, when they get their first one and they get on a bit of a roll and they build a bit of confidence, that it can stem from there. But the chances are certainly more there in the last couple of games than I've seen in previous campaigns.
Fergal, there's been a notable lack of mentions of Aaron Connolly in this conversation.
Yeah, and again, I think he falls into that conversation that Paul mentions about these young strikers. You do get the sense, particularly with Eder, because he has had quite a bit of football under Kenny, that when a chance bounces their way, and they will bury it, hopefully, when it comes. And Connolly is in that conversation. You look at the Portugal game, he was fantastic. Stephen Kenny spoke about it before and after, how they looked to target that space in behind Semedo and Pepe with Connolly's pace. And he did have two or three good chances where he either missed the target or the keeper came out and smothered him. You do really get that sense with Connolly, with Eder, with Parrott, with all of them mixed into this conversation, that when a chance bounces their way and they do eventually get that goal, I don't think there is going to be a flood. I don't think we're going to see goal after goal after goal with them, or them averaging a goal a game or something like that, because as Paul rightly says, we should be realistic in what we expect, but we also shouldn't cut short the potential of these young players. I think striking the balance between those two things is the most important thing for Kenny and the team. And Connolly, for me, in terms of his club career, he has stalled. The two goals that he got against Tottenham, I think it was on his Premier League debut, Brighton tweeted about it this week. That was 2 years ago. That's a long time in Premier League football. And yes, he is young, but questions are going to start to come about him if that rolls on for another season. If he continues to maybe not quite hit the heights for Brighton, there's going to be conversations about, should he stay? Should he maybe take the step down to go and play in the Championship? And ultimately, these are young players, but the next 12 or 18 months will probably have a big, big bearing on not just their international future, on their club future as well. And Eder, unfortunately, at the moment with Norwich, is not getting a massive amount of football. And ultimately, they're going to be in a relegation battle this summer. This season, I should say. And I don't really see Daniel Farker playing him that much. He's full of praise for him and what he does on the training pitch and the little cameos that he gets. But ultimately, he's not really shown any faith in him. So it's going to be a big season for all of them, club and international level. But you get the sense, if there was a goal for Ireland or even a goal on club level, that would give them that kick of confidence that they do need.
I think it would give us all a bit of a kick of confidence, to be honest. Tony O'Donoghue is with us live from Baku. Tony, how are you?
I'm okay, thank you. Yeah, it's quite late here now, and the Irish team have only finished up a short time ago their training session. And the big story, of course, that you've been talking about is the fact that two of the players, Adam Ida and Jason Knight, were unable to train last night. They did take part in training here this evening, but Stephen Kenny has a big decision to make and a big call to make now. He has to put the squad into UEFA tonight. So he can't wait, let them sleep and see how their temperature and their fever was and how it pans out for the morning. He has to make a decision tonight as to whether either or both of them are fit enough to take part in the game. So they were messing around in training. They did take part in the full training in the end. But a decision that Stephen has to make tonight will be a huge bearing on the game, because I think you've been talking about Ida there. He's been very loyal to him, if you like. He's mm-hmm. He's played all the games in the last window. But having said that, the controversy all week over Callum Robinson and the support that he's now received from within the camp, hearing John Egan, who will be captain tomorrow, talk about him, and hearing Stephen talk about him, I think he's decided that Robinson plays tomorrow. So, you know, maybe that's one of his decisions made already.
We often, when previewing games, Tony, we talk about selection dilemmas, but it seems that Stephen has selection issues. For you, what are the big issues facing him now when he's trying to start the 11, okay, aside from what he's going to do with Knight and Ida?
I think he's got to try and find a way to link up the various parts of the play, and I think the midfield is going to be essential. Who he puts in there, Josh Cullen, you'd imagine, will start. Will Jamie McGrath start again? Will Conor Hourihan start? How is he going to do that? I think the defence Okay, we know that Seamus Coleman is missing and Matt Doherty should just slot in there. If he goes a similar way to the last time, he'll play Uma Bamadele, Duffy and Egan. And on the left side, Enda Stevens should probably slot in. But how he links the play between front and back is going to be crucial. And he has those issues, there's no question about that. He's played Cullen in the recent games, in all the games. Will Hendrick come back in? Because Hendrick started against Portugal, mm-hmm. But then didn't play against Azerbaijan. So, yeah, a lot of decisions to make in that regard. And, you know, set pieces are going to be a huge part of the game tomorrow as well. I actually spoke to the Azerbaijan manager, Gianni DiBiase, and I said to him, had he thought about how he was going to stop Shane Duffy? And, you know, he reminds me of Trapattoni, this wily old Italian as well. He said, yes, I've decided I am going to get a killer, a sniper in the stand and take him out that way.
Good bit of humour there, Tony. Just before we let you go, Stephen Kenny did say in the clip that we played a little bit earlier that he's camper confident. They trained well before they headed over and they're just feeling good. Are you getting that sense from them?
I think there's a bit of, to be honest, what happened this week with the COVID situation, the Callum Robinson revelation, if you like, that he didn't want to get vaccinated, that's kind of knocked them for six in a way, because I think it might have the effect of bonding the squad a little bit more. But, you know, it's been a long journey. And then to have Ida and Knight's situation and to be unclear now, tonight, the night before the game, as to whether all your players, many of whom, I mean, I'm certain Ida would have started, but for them to be doubtful puts the whole thing into a bit of chaos. And look, COVID has been the recurring theme of the Stephen Kenny era, really, and illness. I mean, I find it hard to believe that fit young men, it's a long journey here. It's an eight-hour flight, as Stephen was saying, but they had a special charter. They didn't have to hang around Istanbul airport for hours and hours. They had one stop off in Bratislava. And I don't think this is ideal preparation. I don't think what happened over the Callum Robinson and how that developed into a controversy, I don't think how two fit young players who, you know, because they've had PCRs, it's not a COVID issue, but suddenly are in confined to their rooms with fever and high temperature. It's very odd.
It is, Tony. I know it's late over there, so we are going to let you go. Thank you so much for joining us, and hopefully it will go the way of Ireland at the weekend. Fergal Brennan, I'm also going to say goodbye to you. Paul Carey, stay with me. I know there's a penalty about to be taken for the Republic of Ireland against Luxembourg. We'll find out if they scored it after this quick break.
Green Farm. Get back on track after summer with Green Farm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillet range. Available in selected stores nationwide.
From the HSE.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On with me, Marie Crowe. I'm in studio with Paul Carey, who has been keeping a very close eye on the Republic of Ireland against Luxembourg in the under-21s. Paul, we just had a penalty.
Yeah, 2-0. It's Conor Coventry from the spot, he's just slotted down the middle. It was a good break from midfield. Liam Kerrigan, he's knocked it past the fullback, and the fullback, it was probably a bit of a dubious decision, but probably was a penalty in the end. And like I mentioned, Maria, I thought once we got to 60 minutes Luxembourg would start to tire and fade, and I guess that second goal gives us a cushion now, so should be good for the 3 points. It'd be good to see them go on and create a few more chances and even score a few more goals, because it's been a bit of a lacklustre performance.
Jim Crawford was saying he was looking for a bit more of a creative spark. Are we seeing that now?
Yeah, I think so. I think naturally enough, as the game progresses, Luxembourg have to come out of their shape. It leaves spaces, and that's where you want the likes of Coventry and Kilkenny getting the likes of Tierney and Coyote on the ball further up the pitch. So there's going to be opportunities for that in the next 25 minutes. So it'd be good to see them at least create a couple of chances and try open Luxembourg up a bit more.
Yeah, it really would. Right, we're going to take a very quick break and then we're back with the Gavin Casey on Boxing.
Game on 2FM. Green Farm. Healthy dinners made easy with Green Farm's high-protein cooked chicken breast fillets range. Available in selected stores nationwide.
I don't want to hurt Deontay Wilder. I just want to beat him in a fight. And he knows what he's saying is lies. And deep down in his soul, he knows that he lost. And he'll lose again. And he lost the first time. He lost the second time. And he's going to lose the third time.
Game on.
Boxing.
Now it's time to turn our attention to boxing, and it is a huge weekend with the heavyweight fight between Tyson Fury and Deontay Wilder taking centre stage. I'm delighted to be joined on the line by Gavin Casey of The 42 to look ahead to the weekend's action. But Gav, just before we do get into what is going to happen inside the ring, let's just have a quick catch up about what's happening outside the ring. So in June 2020, Fury claimed that Daniel Kinnan had helped broker an agreement for an undisputed title clash with Anthony Joshua. The fight has not happened yet, but those comments really put Kinahan's boxing connection into the spotlight. I know we've had a pandemic since, but there has been a lot happening in the boxing world. Do you think there's more of an awareness now of Kinahan's standing in the boxing world, and do you think people care more?
There's certainly more of an awareness, Marie. Yeah, I'm not sure if people necessarily care more. I suppose just by definition or by mathematics, if more people are aware of it, more people do care about it. But equally then, there are plenty of people, I'd say particularly in the UK and America, who couldn't give two hoots about Daniel Kinnan or who he is. I guess his alleged exploits are foreign to them, whereas they probably hit a little bit closer to home for us, in that obviously the Kinnan organised crime groups effects are felt and seen on the streets of Dublin and so on. I think in a boxing context, there has been always nearly an apathy towards shady characters, mob influence, things like that, and that probably carries through to the modern day. I don't think it necessarily is okay that just because the sport has a history like that, that people accept it now, but that's just people's mindset.
So, like, do we know now what exactly his connection is to Tyson Fury? Because after that, it was an Instagram video when he thanked Daniel for helping to set up that fight. There was kind of a bit of backtracking and everybody kind of ran for cover a little bit as the world reacted to that bomb that Fury dropped. He hasn't really mentioned him much since then, though.
No, I think a couple of weeks even after that backlash began, Fury did have an Instagram story or something in which he said Dan for president, or I think he actually might have said Dan for prime minister. And I guess that was his two fingers to those who were criticising him, criticising Kinnan, Bob Arum, and that whole circle of associates, I guess, that are involved in Fury's career. I would say that it's not on the record, really, or hasn't been on the record since, that Fury is working with Kinnan, but he very obviously is. And Kinnan's influence in the sport hasn't waned whatsoever. I'd say it's actually getting stronger. It's just that it's not quite as visible to people as it was. As you say, what was it, July last year? So that whole sort of association is the driving force behind Fury's career still very much to this day.
Okay, well, let's now turn our attention to his career and what is facing him in the ring. It's going to be quite an interesting one, and I guess probably because of what happened with Anthony Joshua and Usyk as well, like the whole heavyweight division feels like it's turned on its head a little bit. I know experts were giving Usyk quite a lot of hope going into that fight, but there was a lot of, I guess, more the casual fans that thought that Joshua did stand a chance. But I don't think everybody got what they expected in that fight. What are you expecting from this one, though?
I actually don't know. I was on with Damien O'Mara on this show just ahead of the Joshua Usyk fight. I couldn't call it. I'd love fights like those. There's no point in pretending that I'm leaning one way or the other, especially strongly. Obviously, Fury in the last fight against Wilder dismantled him, defused that nuclear right hand that Wilder possesses, and really dressed him down, gave him about as debilitating a defeat as the champion can suffer. And yet I'd say the changes over the 20 intervening months make this almost a 50-50 fight again in my head, in the sense that while Fury is absolutely the superior boxer, and this might be the superior fighter as well based on what we saw in that sequel or that original sequel, you look at the variables involved this time around, right? As you mentioned, Fury would have had his eye on a Joshua fight. And even when Wilder took him to court in order to get this third fight, which was contractually agreed upon, Fury at least had that massive day or massive night out against Joshua as a carrot being dangled beyond the roadblock that is Wilder. So even if he wasn't necessarily stimulated or inspired by the prospective challenge of Wilder a third time, having ostensibly beaten him twice already, because if you remember, their first fight was officially a draw, but Fury was very unlucky not to have gotten the verdict, he still had that massive, mega, multi-million pound fight to look forward to, a sort of a generational all-British clash against Joshua. And then within the snap of a pair of fingers from Ukraine, really, and Alexander Usyk, that, well, it went down the Swanee. And it's interesting in the sense that Fury has been a fighter who traditionally struggles to focus or really needs something to be focusing towards. And I wonder if that carrot being removed from the equation might be potentially detrimental to Fury going into this fight, in that what lays beyond now is a lot less lucrative and almost less prestigious in a way, because you don't get that all-British fight. And then on Wilder's side of things, he's switched up trainers. He's had his eye on Fury for the last 20 months and nobody else. Like, his focus has been absolutely solely, squarely focused on the guy who humiliated him last time around. In their first fight, he knocked Fury down twice. He's one of the biggest punches we've ever seen in the heavyweight division, even if he's not a particularly astute boxer. So do you bet against a guy like that who's absolutely hell-bent on revenge? I certainly wouldn't.
It was just interesting listening to the BBC Bunce podcast today, and he had Fury on and he was talking about how he could help Joshua, that he could train him and try and help him to beat Usyk, which just shows maybe how far the whole thing has fallen. That glamour fight that was billed as being one of the biggest ever is now just feels like it's completely up in flames anyway. But look, one thing about the two of these is that they're, and Fury said this in the podcast, they both know what each other can do. Like, they're not going to have any secrets because they have been in such close contact with each other and close proximity. But like, as you said about Wilder, though, he has had laser focused. He's basically just disappeared since that fight. He's popped up every now and again just to take the odd pop at Fury and to accuse him of all sorts of things. But he really has kept the head down and almost gone away and changed up his the team around him. But can he learn anything new? Can he do anything different?
I'm not sure. He's probably too far gone in his career to be adding tricks to or strings to his bow, so to speak. But I suppose there would be little nuanced things that he might have worked on with his new trainer, Malik Scott. I mean, interestingly, in Scott, you've got a former opponent of Wilder's. Wilder wiped him out in about a round. A lot of people thought Scott actually took a dive in that fight because it wasn't the most punishing of rounds. But now they're working together, and I guess in Scott you have a guy who was always a very tricky heavyweight to pin down himself. He was known as a kind of a more slick, fleet-footed heavyweight, never had a great deal of power. Wilder is the absolute polar opposite of that, in the sense that his footwork isn't great and he doesn't move a great deal, but he has absolute atomic bombs in his fists. So that is a little interesting wrinkle, in the sense that you wonder what Scott can implement in Wilder's game. And again, I don't think it can be anything drastic, but a couple of little subtle things when you're looking at footage for 20 months, if you're not gone blind to it by that point, I'm sure they will have figured out a couple of ways in which, if not, that it might make it easier for Wilder to actually land something on Fury that maybe makes him a little bit more defensively astute or capable, so that if Fury looks to sort of mow him down again, he doesn't have quite as easy a job doing so.
It's been a bit of a chaotic few months, though, for Fury. Just, I know he had that difficult situation when Paris had the new baby and the baby was unwell for a while. So that obviously would have had a massive impact on him emotionally, and then also just disrupting what he was trying to do to prepare for the fight. Do you think that he is in the shape that he needs to be? I know all the detractors and probably a few commentators as well are saying that he isn't. But there's a lot of people that are seeing him in the last few days who think he's in great shape.
I have no idea, to be honest, and I won't have an idea until we see them step on the scales, which should be later on tonight. But I suppose one thing I'd say is that in the last fight or ahead of it, when Fury very deliberately bulked up, and like people listening will be aware, he's already a colossus of a man, but he came in sort of heavier than he had done in the original fight by, what, I think 15 or so pounds, if I'm not mistaken. And people were a little bit concerned at that point that he wasn't in fighting shape, or that he'd put on too much weight and he wouldn't be as mobile and he was playing into Wilder's hands. And we saw what happened. He's not always the most chiseled-looking fellow. He's not a Greek statue, but whatever he has going on anatomically sort of works for him. And so I kind of wouldn't read too much into him physically necessarily ahead of this, because as we saw, even with Wilder last time, he'd put on a little bit of weight. He still looked absolutely phenomenal, looked like a Greek statue, but couldn't stand up to Fury's pressure. It's interesting you mentioned the things going on in Fury's background that might have been a distraction in this lead-up. And Andy Lee, who was absolutely instrumental to Fury's victory last time around, isn't in Las Vegas with him this time because of visa complications. So that's just another little, another little doubt that might be in the back of Fury's mind. And there are a few of these little wrinkles now that are thrown into the equation that, as I say, make it seem like on paper, being a closer fight than it should have been based on what we saw the last time.
He seems to be a little bit quieter, though, in the build-up to this as well. Like, he's even gone off social media, like, which he, you know, he's usually quite present in different kind of guises, whether it's on Paris's stories or his own platforms as well. But he does seem to have really kind of brought things back quite a lot.
Yeah, and it's possibly something he needed to do in order to properly focus on this fight, because, again, it's not the most tantalizing of prospects for him to fight a very dangerous fighter, admittedly, but a fighter who he has, again, pretty much beaten twice already. Like, Wilder is viewing this as a sort of his way to level a series between them. One draw, one win for Fury, and then if Wilder wins tomorrow night, you get probably a fourth fight, a rubber match. But for Fury, it's 2-0. And I would suggest that if it wasn't him who decided to come off social media, I'm sure it would have been said to him, he needs tunnel vision through this fight, because just knowing his attitude and speaking to people who've worked with him in the past, even Andy, I think, has said it on the record, Andy Lee, that you almost have to be looking over his shoulder throughout camp, making sure he's not getting distracted, but also making sure he's still interested and just happy. You know, he's obviously a guy who has gone on the record himself, Fury, as having had mental health problems and things like that. He needs looking after in training camp, and maybe for this one, being off social media is the right move. Again, it's something we might look back upon after the fight and say, well, that worked for him.
He does seem quite content, though. Like, just any time I've heard him now over the last few days, he's quite accepting of where he is in life and quite happy, and has seemed to come to the realisation that he doesn't want any more than what he has right now, which is obviously a lot, just in terms of family and finances and things like that. But, you know, he just feels like he's not chasing anything else, and he just is happy boxing. How long more he's going to be able to do that for is a bit of a worry for him, because he's definitely someone that is going to struggle to cope with life after sport. He said he's tried loads of different hobbies. He's not into anything at all. He's tried animals. He's tried clay pigeon shootings. He's tried, you know, the fancy cars. He's tried everything, and he can't find anything to even compare to what he has now, which is a boxing career, and he's on the top of his game, which would make you think maybe he's going to really realise that this time is precious and he needs to make the most of it, because it's going to be gone pretty quickly.
Very possibly. I'd suggest so. That can often work the other way as well, Marie. I think if you look back at Anthony Joshua against Andy Ruiz, I was in New York that week for the first fight when Ruiz shocked the boxing world, shocked the sporting world by stopping Joshua. Katie Taylor was on the undercard, which brought me over there, but I was at press conferences in which Joshua was, you know, he seemed similarly content, and he started speaking about the bigger picture and how boxing wasn't necessarily the be-all and end-all, and he has other business interests and so on that we know about. And that's always a sort of a dangerous mindset, to my mind, for a fighter to be in, because it is a sport that requires almost a borderline sociopathic dedication.
Yeah, but and Gav, in fairness to Fury, he said that there is nothing else bar boxing, as in there is no bigger picture. Like, this is it. This is all he wants. Like, he doesn't want to do anything else, doesn't care about anything else. The only thing that makes him happy is boxing.
Yeah, that's fair. But I suppose it's the fact that he was looking at all for other things. The mind was wandering maybe a little bit. No, but I take your point. And listen, it does seem to be all he has, and if he is putting absolutely everything into it, then he should win this fight, no question. Mm-hmm. It's just that it's one of those things where it's difficult to take at face value anything Fury says.
Yeah, it's true, difficult
to take at face value anything that Wilder says. The ring is the greatest lie detector in sport. We'll find out.
Okay, right. Well, what way do you think it's going to go? I know that you're finding it very hard to call it, but just in terms of a fight, like, it does feel like a really good match between these two would do the world a good for the sport of boxing.
It probably would, yeah. And I suppose, in fairness, Usyk's upset over Joshua was a pretty big one as well. But in terms of how it's going to go, gone to my head, I would say Fury gets the job done again. I think the beating that he gave Wilder last time is bound to give him a sort of a... Not only that it'll psychologically boost Fury, but actually even more so, in a more pronounced way, I would say Wilder will have the spooks a little bit if it gets hairy in there, and Fury knows he can finish it now. So that's how I would just about expect it would go. But honestly, any possible outcome wouldn't shock me.
Yeah, these ones are so hard to call. Okay, let's turn our attention to back home for a second, Gav. And there's a little bit of news breaking just as we came on air that Ireland will not have representatives at the 2021 Men's World Boxing Championships in Belgrade this month. That has been reported right now. Boxers at the High Performance Unit were reportedly informed of the decision this week, which seems all very, very strange.
Yeah, it is strange for sure. I suppose we'd heard whispers of it within boxing over the last few days, and initially you're incredulous. And to be honest, I remain incredulous. I think it's an extremely conservative decision. It seems to be motivated by this feeling among coaches, I don't know, maybe Bernard Dunn, High Performance Unit Director, that some of the fighters who won elite championships last weekend wouldn't necessarily be ready to compete at the Worlds, and basically the team going over minus Olympians would be too green. The coaches in the High Performance Unit haven't worked with all of the Irish champions currently, and I guess this sense that you get from, again, it's more so you get it through the grapevine from the HBU, that if we went over there with this very young and inexperienced team, that it would be somehow embarrassing to lose fighters in the first, second round of the tournament and so on, and that they're better served earning their experience at multi-nations tournaments, sort of lower profile tournaments over the next year or so, and then go again maybe towards the Worlds when they're hopefully incorporated into the High Performance Unit that little bit more. Look, it's an ideological thing and I wouldn't agree with it necessarily. Ken Egan, who's been on your show, I think does agree with it, you know, so there is a bit of a split in opinion. I'm disappointed for the fighters that they don't get the opportunity to represent Ireland on the world stage when I'm sure that was the, in some sense, the motivation in entering the elites in the first place. And also because this time around at the World Championships, there's significant prize money on offer.
Yeah,
it's 100,000, I think 100,000 euro or dollars, I'm not sure, for a gold medal, 50 grand for a silver, and I think 25 for a bronze. Like, these are people who are often take time off work to train and things like that. So to miss out on the opportunity to actually make cash as well as an amateur is really disappointing for them.
Yeah, it does seem like an absolute huge call. I'm looking forward to at some stage hearing from some of their boxers, the boxers, and getting their thoughts on it. Gavin, thank you so much for joining me. Enjoy the weekend. It is a big one, and no doubt we'll have plenty to discuss next week.
Game on. Boxing.
Paul Corrie, the Ireland under 21 match against Luxembourg is nearly over. They are 2-0 up. They should see it out at this stage.
Yeah, they should do, Marie. Brian Moran goal in the back four have had very little to do. They've dominated much of the second half with maybe not creating too many chances, but I think after drawing with Luxembourg last time out, it was just important for Jim Crawford to get another 3 points, and a win today leaves them 2 points behind Italy in second and three behind Sweden, who are top of the group with a game in hand. So very much still alive in that group, and the games against Sweden and Italy obviously going to be vitally important if we are to have an opportunity of either the second place playoff or to win the group.
Okay, Paul Corrie, thank you so much for coming in. That's all from us today and for the week. The official chart show with Blona Tracy is up next.
With Green Firm. Fuel your day with Green Firm's high-protein cooked chicken breast fillets. 100% natural and packed with flavour.